I wanted to say thank you to you all, from those of us who are strangers from Hoosier Land, and I'd go ahead and include Florida in that. We couples from outside your particular area have particularly appreciated being welcomed the way we have. We've felt that you not only opened the doors of your program and your conference to us, but that you have indeed opened the doors of your hearts to us. And we've felt very welcome. And I've talked with the others on this over and over again. And we feel now that we know a little bit more about what it is that Jesus Christ is doing in your parts of the country. We look forward to meeting with you and being with you around the throne of grace. There, there'll no longer be any parting. But in the meantime, we also pray that God will bring us together from time to time here on earth again. And we want you to know that you have a particular place in our hearts. And we'd like to see you in our homes, too. I say particularly for those of us from Indianapolis that we'd welcome your presence there anytime. And if we happen to be in the part of country where you are, you can expect to find a telephone call coming in anytime. But please do hunt us up, and we do say thank you to you for the way in which you've opened your hearts and your lives to us here, and we've enjoyed being with you. This is surely an earnest of the fellowship that we can really look forward to for eternity in heaven, as those who love Christ gather together around His Word and praise Him and study Him and then go out for Him. I wanted to talk with you out of another book this evening, out of the book of Job, as a matter of fact. And Job is one of those books that many people hear about, but that few people have done much study in. One of the things that's driven me into it, interestingly enough, in recent years, has been the fact that in our literature courses in the university, the book of Job is one that they very often take up. However, there's a more important reason than that for our studying the book of Job. It's a family book. In addition to the fact that it's very often not known, it is a book that God can use insofar as family relationships are concerned. I had one other funny. I have about so many on a list, you know, and at the risk of identifying anyone by the name of Boom Boom, again, I'd like to tell you, however, about one of these men. I don't know who it is that has fallen heir to this particular name, and I presume that no one here has. But this particular boy, incidentally, had, well, he'd really bothered the coach. He'd been there 4 years. This was a fourth year, and he hadn't had any dates. And the coach thought that there was something wrong, and so he went to the boy and he said, "Son," he said, "there's something missing about your education, your training here, and I'd like to help you out a little bit with this. Let me suggest that you should at least accompany a young lady to for a whole evening someplace." And he said, "Now, just as soon as the season's over, I'll set this up for you. I'll go ahead and approach someone and sort of open the way, and then you go to her. And let me instruct you about what you do. The first thing you do is you find a good restaurant and you make a reservation there, and then you go ahead to make sure that there's a good film. And before that, though, you also buy a good news magazine. So that there'll be a good topic of conversation between you for the whole evening. And then you take her home. And after you've seen the film, you take her home and you stand her right up in front of the porch light and you look right down into her beautiful eyes and you say, 'You are the most beautiful creature that I have ever seen.' And then, I forget what comes next. I blew it. Then you kiss her right on the end of the nose. And then he says, 'Then what, coach?' And the coach says, 'Then she'll tell you what, son.' And so he did. I mean, they finished the season, and he did. He found the restaurant, and he bought a Newsweek magazine, and they had to postpone the date for a week. It took them how long to get through it. But they then she said yes, and so they went together to the restaurant. They had a good topic conversation. He took her to a Walt Disney film. And right after that, he took her home, and he stood her right up in front of the porch light, and he looked her right in the eye, and he said, "You are the most beautiful creature that ever lived." And he kissed her right on the end of the nose. And she said, "And a little lower, please." And he blushed from top to bottom, and he said, "You are the most beautiful creature." Find a moral to the story, it's simply this. Let's make sure we're a little better informed about Job than he was about the facts. And we'll go ahead at this point to look into the book of Job for just a little bit. The book itself is divided into five scenes. Five scenes. The first scene, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. I'll read these. Just a moment here as we start at this point. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons went and feasted in their houses every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now that's scene one. And it tells us quite a bit about the chief character here. It's Job. It tells us, for example, that he lived in Uz. We don't know where Uz was, but we do know, according to that first verse, that this was God's estimate of this man. He's a perfect and an upright man, one who feared God and eschewed evil. The word for perfect here, the Hebrew word, is tamim. It does not mean that he was perfect in the sense that Jesus Christ was perfect, having never sinned. It does mean that he was an all-round good man. He did the same thing whether there was anyone there to see whether he did it or not. He was the kind of man who would open the car door for his wife whether there were any people watching or not. He was always the same. Whether there were people there or he was alone, he was always the same. Perfect in this sense of the word. That's what the word tamim means. And this is God's estimate of this man. And please don't forget that from beginning to end. God looked at that man and God said, "Now there is a perfect and an upright man, one who fears me and who eschews evil." And beyond that, he's a family man. Verse 2, "There were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. That was a healthy sized family. We'll find out the names of some of those a little bit later on. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men in the east. He was an exceedingly wealthy man. The east has produced her millionaires. This man would have been among those. The stocks of those days are not quite the same as the stocks and bonds of today, but nevertheless, this man would have been a multimillionaire. He was the wealthiest, the greatest of all the men of the east. And verse 4, his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. Now that sounds to us like a usual thing. That is, they each one took a day and had a family reunion. One day it was in Jim's house, another day, a month or so later, or maybe a year later, it was in Tom's house. Everyone his day. The sons and the daughters. But the important thing is that they sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. Now that would have been a shattering of the social barriers of that day. According to some of the old philosophers from back in about that time, there were 3 levels of life. There was the dumb brute at the bottom, and there was man, masculine, at the top. And someplace in between these two came woman. She wasn't quite down on a level there, but she certainly didn't begin to approach this standard up here. And men never associated with women. But somehow or other, old Job had been able to shatter the social barriers of that day. And when these sons, when these brothers had a family reunion, they invited their sisters with them. Now that was a very unusual standard. Apparently, when Job's sons and daughters went to high school, they didn't do everything. In fact, they did some things that the others didn't do. He was an unusual man. This was an unusual family. And beyond that, Job is more than just the oldest male member in his household. That's about the only identification there is for some fathers. But look at the next verse, verse 5. So it was, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. He rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. He got up early in the morning to pray for his family. And this word for cursed God in their hearts is a very interesting literal translation of it. It means, say farewell to God. I just don't have time for God. That's what the meaning of the word cursed God in their hearts. Say farewell to God. This old man saw his family, and the sons and daughters were moving out into business, and they're becoming more and more busy, and the business is driving them. And he says, "Oh God, keep them from coming to the place of just saying, 'Well, I just don't have time for God. Goodbye, God. Just don't have time. Goodbye, God. Farewell, God.'" And this is his prayer for his children. And this is the introduction to the man itself. He rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Wealthy old Oriental monarch, long white beard probably, sitting out there on the edge of his ranch, and the ranches beyond the edge of the horizon belonged to his sons. Wealthy in every sense of the word. Wealthy in terms of life. Wealthy in terms of social relationships. Wealthy in terms of his spiritual relationship with God. Wealthy in every sense of the word. That's the end of scene one. Scene two begins in verse 6. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, 'Whence comest thou?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down in it.' And the Lord said unto Satan, 'Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? That thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased. But put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face.' And the Lord said unto Satan, 'Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand.' So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord." Now, you tell me where this scene is taking place. The first scene is obviously on earth. Where is this scene taking place, according to verse 6? "There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord." Where's that?
Heaven.
Yeah, heaven. What's the only problem with that? Satan. Huh. I've had enough trouble with him down here. I sort of hoped he wouldn't be up there. Now, on the other hand, maybe it's a good thing he is up there. Well, let's not let Satan scare us out at this point, because there's a conversation going on, and you and I are listening in behind the scenes. And when these two begin to talk, I think we can learn something. "The Lord said to Satan, 'When I was on board ship and went in to see the captain, I know who spoke first, and it wasn't me.'" The man who was skipper spoke first. And I take it that that's what's going on there. And God says to Satan, "Satan, where have you been? Sound off, man. Give an accounting of yourself." And Satan does. He says, "From shooting to and fro." It's "from going to and fro" in the King James. But actually the Hebrew means "from shooting to and fro throughout the earth, and from walking up and down in it." And elsewhere we read he's as a lion going about. The word here, the Hebrew word, is the same word that they have for lightning. The way lightning never strikes. And this is the word that Satan uses. This is the way he's saying, "I work. Now let's listen in on this thing. It's interesting. They're telling us something. As Satan says, from shooting to and fro throughout the earth, from walking up and down, sort of an insolent answer. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? Don't forget this. It is God who calls Satan's attention to Job. It is not Satan who notices Job first. Satan says, I've been shooting to and fro throughout the earth. And God says, you have you? Have you noticed Job? He's a good man. With all your shooting to and fro, Satan, he's a good man. Have you seen him? Look. Look, Satan, look at him. A perfect and upright man, one who fears me and eschews evil. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, ha, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But you put forth your hand and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, all right, behold, all that he hath is in thine hand, is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan shot forth from the presence of the Lord, just like that. Now, do you get what it is that Satan's saying there? He's saying, yeah, I see Job. And it's an insolent sneer, but it's an intelligent one. He's pious, all right. He's godly because he's prosperous. But you let me lay my finger on some of that prosperity, and he'll curse you to your face. Do you get the point of that? Suppose God were to take away some of your prosperity. Would you continue to love God or not? Satan says not. He says, you let me at somebody. You let me at. You build a hedge about him. I can't get to him. All is good that you're giving him. I can't get to him. But you let me get to him and take away some of that prosperity, and he'll curse you to your face. He's godly because he's prosperous. You remove that prosperity, and he'll say, goodbye, God. If God's going to do that to me, I don't have any more time for him. I don't know what it would require to take away from you in order for you to come to the point of saying, well, goodbye, God. But that's what Satan's saying. And so God says, all right, all right. But Satan, listen, you can go so far and no farther. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. You remember the story of Tom Sawyer, or was it Huckleberry Finn? And the bully wanted to fight, and he drew a line in the dust with his toe, and he says, all right, step across it. Go ahead, I dare you. Step right across that line. And I rather get the impression that God is saying the same thing to Satan here. You will go so far and no farther, just to that line. I'm glad to hear these two talking that way, because every once in a while, someone says to me, in one way or another, you know, I really wonder if this thing has gotten out from under God. I wonder who is in control, really. Well, we're listening in behind the scenes right now in a family situation. And when that mother said to me, after the drunken driver had killed her little girl out in front of the house, was that Satan or was that God? I was able to show her this. And God spoke through that to her life in answering that question. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. Satan does not work outside of the permission of God. And God here is putting the control, a very fine line of control, upon Satan. Well, that's the end of scene two. Scene three begins in verse 13. Satan shot forth from the presence of the Lord in verse 12. In verse 13, there was a day when his sons, Job's sons and his daughters, were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. They were over Bob's house that day, a family reunion, in their eldest brother's house. his sons and his daughters. The sisters were with him. Verse 14, there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing, the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servant with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the Chaldeans have made out three bands and fell upon the camels and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another. He said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, smote the four corners of the house, it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And you get the picture there? This old man, wealthy, oriental monarch, sitting underneath his palm tree or whatever it was. I don't know why he wasn't at the family reunion that day. Maybe dad and mother were a little too old for the folks, or some too old to travel or something, but they were at home. And Job looks up and he sees this servant running across the horizon and up the path there, and a servant didn't run in the heat of the day unless there was something wrong, and he thinks, what is this? And the oxen, the asses, the Sabaeans fell upon them, and every one of the servants taken. And while he was yet speaking, there came another servant. He saw this other one running up the way here. The sheep, every one of them lost. And while he was speaking, the Chaldeans, the third servant came in, the Chaldeans. And here's this old man sitting there, and his mathematical mind, I think, was clicking those financial losses off one right after another. And it's hard for us to realize this because not all our money's tied up in that kind of stock today. But you ask anyone who went through the Depression and who saw that stock market fall, and from a position of tremendous wealth, within a very few minutes, he's reduced to a position of terrific poverty. And he only had one other precious possession. And as he looked out there, he saw another servant come running from that direction. And I think his heart froze a little bit. And then he heard that telephone call concerning the accident in the middle of the night. And every one of his children were taken. If there had only been one for the wealth of the love of the human heart to dwell upon, but there was not one left. And Job is one of the greatest specimens of grief that is to be described any place in Scripture. It's not an animal that can understand grief, but Job exemplifies human grief. In verse 20, old Job arose and he rent his mantle and he shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And I think he said those next words through clenched teeth. He said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. If God hadn't given me so much in the first place, I couldn't have lost so much. You see, you and I stand here tonight and we say, yes, sure, but this has all been planned in heaven. But Job didn't know that any more than you and I know what's going to happen to us by the time we arrive home a few hours hence. Job didn't know that. He hadn't heard God say, now there is a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. It's as though there was a stage there, and there's a stage wall in between, and on this side's the conversation between God and Satan, and we're allowed to hear into that, and on this side's Job, and he's not allowed to hear into that, and he doesn't know what God's saying, and he doesn't see. All he knows is that these things are happening to him. One right after another, these things are happening. He doesn't see it as a test. He just knows that it's happening to him. And in all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Chapter 2, verse 1 is the fourth scene. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Where's this taking place? Back in heaven again. back in heaven again. And Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said unto Satan, From whence comest thou? Report. Sound off. And Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and fro on the earth, from walking up and down. The same thing. Conversation's almost exactly the same here at the beginning of the second chapter as it was back there in the first. And the Lord said to Satan in verse 3, Hast thou considered my servant Job? There's none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. And still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movedest me against him to destroy him without a cause. Satan, you see? He's still not cursed me. He's still not said, well, goodbye God. If God's going to deal with me that way, then goodbye to him. I don't have any more time for him. He's not saying that, Satan. You said he would, but he's not. Now, where do you go? In verse 4, Satan answered the Lord and he said, skin for skin. All the man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. Do you get again the significance of the sneer and the challenge that Satan is throwing there? He's saying this, there are some men who are so basically and intrinsically selfish that unless they're hurting at the very synapses, doesn't really matter. Other things, even their own family, you can take away from them. But you make them hurt physically, and then they'll say, Goodbye, God. I just don't have time for him. And so, this is a loophole that Satan has spotted. And God knows that so long as there's one loophole, Satan will use it. And so he says, All right, Satan, you go ahead and try him even at that point. But save his life. And remember this. If it comes to the point that Satan loses this test, he would love to have taken that life. If he could have. If he could have. But you tell me who's obviously in control of life. Souls do not go unbidden into the presence of God. He's in control of that life. But save his life. You can go just that much closer, Satan, but no farther. And God is controlling, and I'm glad to see that today. Because as I look at the world sometimes, I begin to wonder about the sovereignty of our God. It would be easy for me to become very pessimistic as a Christian. And many Christians have become thus. But then I go back and I read things like this, and I know that God is in control of Satan. And the next scene, the fifth scene, begins in verse 7. And from here throughout the end to the end of the book, we're down on earth. For that's where it is. Satan shot forth from the presence of the Lord. He wasted not an instant. But in verse 7, he smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal. And he sat down among the ashes. I'd still like to see some physician who would dig into the real meaning of the Hebrew words that are used here. The word for boils really doesn't do it justice. The same word is related elsewhere to leprosy, an incurable disease. We find a little bit later on that, well, right here in verse 8 it is, that Job sat down among the ashes. The ash heap was the place of quarantine for the communities in those days. No hope. Incurable disease. You go out there and sit there till you die. And that's what he had to look forward to. The flesh would fester and crack into the bone, and one by one the fingers drop off. And the face became so disfigured that they couldn't even recognize it. And from a man of tremendous wealth and respectability and honor in every sense of the word, with a wonderful future and children to carry that future into the next generations, he's suddenly reduced to the point of poverty, disrespect, pain, nothing but death and quarantine to look forward to. I want you to tell me what kind of a wife Molly was, because we have her described in the next two verses. And I'd like one of the ladies to tell me what kind she is. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speak. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? And in all this did not Job sin with his lips? You tell me what kind of woman she was, a Jewel or a Jezebel? Good or bad? Well, ladies only, excuse me. What? Oh, now you're being hard on Molly. Anyone else? Can you think of anything better than that to say? See, I didn't want to say this, man, but go ahead. She loved her husband. How'd you know she did? You're right. That's it, exactly. She did not want to see him suffer. Now, you're right back there when you say that she was... She counseled him to say the very thing that Satan said he'd say. And that sounds like Jezebel very much. But when we get that back to the question of why she said that, we come to this point here. She loved her husband so much, she just couldn't stand to see him suffer. And you see, she'd been close to him. And her faith rested on two pillars. One was the integrity of God, and the other was the integrity of her husband. And she knew her husband had not done anything to cause this kind of suffering. She knew the very thing that God had said about Job was true. That is, God said he was a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. And she knew that about him. She'd lived with him. The only thing left to doubt was God's integrity. So she did. That pillar went down. And she said, Job, why don't you just say goodbye to God? But you see, she counseled her husband in distraction. She loved him so much. And she didn't realize what would have happened. If he had cursed God and then not died, he'd have been more miserable than he was before. And if he'd cursed God and then had died, he'd have gone into the very presence of the God that he had just cursed. And Job can't understand this. He speaks in amazement there. He says, what? Are we going to accept good at the hand of God down through all these years and then not expect this little bit of evil? This little bit of bad? Molly, you're not yourself today. You're speaking like one of the foolish women. I don't understand. You see, this was the point of the real temptation. It had been Satan's dilemma. He could have had Job's wife also removed at that same time, I think. But he chose to save her until the resistance was low, that she might be the straw that would break the camel's back. And it wouldn't have been any temptation to Job either if he had loved his wife. But he loved her, and he learned to respect her counsel all down through the years. I think we could see Job sitting there in earlier years in front of his tent, and Molly sitting back there in the tent, and a camel driver comes by with a flock of camels to sell, and he'd look them over, and she'd been sitting there, and she hadn't paid any attention to the camels, but she'd been watching the camel driver, Job comes back in and he says, what do you think, Molly? I think I'm going to buy that three-year-old. She says, no, don't do it. Don't do it. She hadn't seen the camels. Or she just looked at the camel driver. Her discernment of minion. And he said, well, I'm going to anyway. And he went ahead anyway. And the next morning he got up and it was sway. Well, it wouldn't be sway back camel, I guess, but there'd be everything wrong with it. Eh? Down through the years, and instance after instance after instance, he had learned to trust her counsel. But now she counseled him at that instant, at that particular instant. And this was the temptation. You see, Satan is hitting Job now, not through his family and his flocks and his herds, and through his physical pain, but through his friends, especially his wife. I believe that she was a jewel. She certainly was not a Jezebel. She wasn't a gold digger, we'll put it that way. She didn't leave him as soon as all his money was gone. She stuck with him. He's on the ash heap and she's there with him. And we find her in the last chapter still with him. And no godly man ever lived out a life on earth happy with that one who was closest to him on earth, knowing that that one would not be with him in heaven for eternity. No godly man ever lived happily with an ungodly wife, knowing that she would not be with him in heaven for eternity. And Job and Molly did live together, clear through to the last chapter, as we're going to see very shortly. But this wasn't the end of this particular kind of thing. In verse 11, Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him. They came, everyone, from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. It wasn't just that they happened to be riding out across the desert one day and suddenly thought they'd drop in on poor old Job. They heard that he was ill, and so they came for the express purpose of comforting him. Now, don't forget that and all that happens hereafter. They came for the express purpose of comforting him, and when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. They couldn't even recognize him. His face was so disfigured. They rent everyone his mantle, sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights. That was a period of mourning. He was as good as dead. And none spake a word, for they saw that his grief was very great. He good as dead. Poor old man stretched out there on the ash heap waiting to die. Miserable. And the greatest of his misery would have been the question, why? Why? Why did all this happen to me? But he's not quite dead. He's not quite dead. We go on to the third chapter, and we find there's quite a little bit of life in this old fellow yet. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed his day. Yeah. Here's a commentary that says that Job was a mighty precocious baby. He cursed the day he was born. Job spake. That's not what he's doing. He says in verse 3, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said there's a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it." If there hadn't been a February the 7th, 1925, I never would have been born if I could just tear that day right out of the calendar. And the old man may be pretty weak, but there's a lot of life there. And remember this when you begin understanding and hearing people say that he's the most patient man that ever lived. The New Testament word that's used to describe Job is endurance. It's endurance. In the King James, it says patience, but the Greek word means endurance. And remember that as we go along, because this sounds like a very impatient man to me. Endurance, but still with impatience. And he says, "I wish I'd never been born. This would never have happened to me if that had been the case." And after he goes on there through the whole third chapter, then in chapter 4, the comforter, the man who's made a special point of making an appointment to come to comfort him, Eliphaz, the oldest one. We know he's oldest because he speaks first. That's Oriental custom. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and he said, "If we essay to commune with thee," I think we can see him pulling on his beard, "wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, Job, in years gone by, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled." In years gone by, Job, every time somebody had troubles like this, you were always the man that was on hand to encourage them and comfort them and help them and explain to them what had happened. But now it's happened to you, Job. Now it's happened to you. Verse 6, "Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, the uprightness of thy ways? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same." What kind of comfort is that? The first part is, he said, "Job, you've done all these good things to other people down through the years. Now some bad things happen to you. Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same." What kind of a candy-coated pill of comfort is that? You're just getting what you deserve, Job. You've plowed iniquity and you've sowed wickedness and now you're getting the results of it. You're hurting. You deserve it. And he goes on down through there for the remainder of that chapter and the very next chapter too, the fifth chapter, saying the same thing all the way through. One way after another, he says the same thing. "You've sinned, therefore you're going to suffer. If you're suffering, it means you must have sinned. We see you're suffering. You must have sinned. Can't be any other explanation for it. That's it. That's it. That's it. Chapter 6, however, old Job answered and he said, "Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit, the terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. Doth the wild ass bray when he hath grass? Or loweth the ox over his fodder?" You don't even find a wild ass making a noise when he has something to eat. If I had the explanation for this thing, I wouldn't be crying. What I'm telling you is that there's something more to this than meets the eye. I know I haven't done the kind of sin that could deserve this kind of suffering. I know I always said what you've said before. But I also know that if I had done the kind of sin that would deserve this kind of suffering, I'd know it. And I'm making a noise. Because it's not the case. There's something new in this situation now. Well, he goes on there for two chapters saying the same thing over and over again. Chapter 8, then answered Bildad the Shuhite. Bildad was the second one. The first one spoke out of experience. Even as I have seen the old man. Even as I have seen. You've seen an old man counseling out of even as I have seen experience. Now, Bildad didn't have that experience. He didn't have that age. But he said, how long wilt thou speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression, if thou wouldst seek unto God betimes, and make thy supplication to the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee, and make the habitation of thy righteous prosperous. And then he goes ahead to speak for God. He even speaks about Job's children probably deserving their deaths. That's a queer kind of comfort. And old Job isn't quite dead yet. He goes on over to chapter 9. In chapter 9, Job answers Bildad and he says, Then answered Job and he said, "I know it is so of a truth, but how should a man be just with God? If he will contend with him, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. He's wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who hath hardened himself against him and hath prospered?" And Job says over and over again there, down through those next two chapters, "I know what you've said is what I've always said through life, but I say again that I have not done the kind of sin that could cause this kind of suffering. There must be something more." And of course you and I know there's something more because we listened in on this other side of the stage wall. It's a test, isn't it? It's a test. And these men are being used to test Job that much further. Well, the 11th chapter has to do with Zophar. Now, Zophar is the youngest of all of them. And he had neither age nor history. Bildad, I think, was a historian. But Zophar had neither age nor history from which to speak. He's just able to think. I think he had a brand new RFD or PhD or something like that straight out of the mail order catalog. And he's just able to think. And so this boy comes to the old man. And he's going to set him straight in a little bit of time there in verse 11. "Then answered Zophar the Naamathite, and he said, Should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be justified? Should thy lies, Job, make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, My doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is." And then he goes ahead to explain to Job the secrets of God's wisdom. This is his boy explaining to the old man the secrets of God's wisdom. And chapter 12, Job surely isn't dead. Job answers and he says, "No doubt but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these? I am as one mocked of his neighbor." Hey, quite a bit of life in the old fellow yet, isn't there? And you can see how this is wearing in at him. Job, are you ready to say goodbye, God? Job goes on through chapters 12 and 13, and we don't have time to go into these, but you can follow through that line of argument. You'll find as you do that in one chapter after another, it's Bildad, and then Job answers, and Zophar, and then Eliphaz, and Bildad, and Zophar, and an answer from Job in each one of them. Clear over to chapter 19. And in chapter 19, Job says at the beginning, he says, "How long will you vex me in pieces? Vex my soul and break me in pieces. These 10 times have you reproached me, and you're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me. Be it indeed that I have erred, mine error remaineth with myself." And then he goes on up here in verse 14. He says, "My kinsfolk have failed me. My familiar friends have forgotten me. They that dwell in mine house and my maids count me for a stranger. I'm an alien in their sight. I called my servant and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. My breath is strange to my wife, though I entreated for the children's sake of my body. Yea, my children despise me. I rose and they spake against me. All my inward friends abhorred me." Verse 20, "My bone cleaveth to my skin, to my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth. Have pity upon me, oh, have pity upon me, ye friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do you persecute me as God, and are not satisfied with my flesh?" Now listen, I'm going to tell you something. And the next words that I say to you, I want to make sure that they are written. Oh, that these next words were now written and that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and led into the rock forever. And they had a custom over there of carving into the stone, and then they pour lead into it. And the wind and the rain and the weather would wash off the stone, but the lead would remain. And he said, "I want these next words, which explain the whole situation, led into the rock for everyone to read long after I am dead. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." But the important words are those in the 25th verse. And as far as I'm concerned, they're the theme for the entire book. The 19th chapter in the 25th verse. "For I know that my Redeemer liveth." And you know, of course, those words have sung themselves around the world. "For I know that my Redeemer liveth." Isn't that part of the Messiah or some of the Christmas music? "I know that my Redeemer liveth." And when God chose that particular word for Redeemer, it's Goel. It's the word that was used to describe Boaz, kinsman, blood brother. "I know that my blood brother liveth." It means also vindicator, the one who will vindicate, who will make right any of the suffering that I've done. And it means Redeemer, the one who will buy back anything that may have been lost. "I know that my Redeemer, blood brother, vindicator, does live, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth." That these things will be made right. Now the three friends don't take that as the end, and they go on and on through here for a long time. But finally in chapter 38... another man comes into the picture, a man by the name of Elihu. We won't take up anything about him. His counsel is a little better than those of the other three, but not much. In chapter 38, finally the Lord reaches down. "The Lord then answered Job out of the whirlwind, and he said, Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, Job, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." Job, you demanded back there, and we didn't have time to look at those places, but in a number of places Job said, "God, I desire to plead my case." And he uses the Hebrew language of the attorney. He says, "I desire to present my brief to God." That's what he says back there, according to the Hebrew. I want to present my brief to God, my case. I like to reason my own case before God. And he's pretty demanding about that. And so God's merely reminding him of this here in the first part of the 38th chapter. He said, "Job, you desired to plead your case before me. Now let's reason it. Now let's reason it. But before we begin to reason your case, Job, I need to ask you a few questions. I need to check your IQ. We have to go through these things first, and then we can go on so that I'll know where I can begin in explaining to you a little bit about the questions, the situations. In the questions that we have remaining there in that 38th chapter, the first one that he asks has to do with the foundations of the earth. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" in verse 4. Now, what is it that holds our old earth in position here, centrifugal and centripetal forces? What is it that keeps it just at that angle of incidence from the sun, which makes it possible for men to live rather than to burn to death or to freeze to death? What is it that keeps it at just such a distance from the sun and from the other planets? What is that? The foundations of the earth. Well, we're still studying some of those things. We don't quite understand all of them yet. We have a few more of those to understand. And then going on down in verse 8, what about the springs of the sea? Verse 8, who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth? Well, we're going down to check on some of those things now. We haven't been to the bottom yet. But we're still going down into the sea to try to find out where it comes from and where the springs of the sea actually are. And verse 9, let's go the other direction for a little while. I made the cloud the garment thereof, the thick darkness a swaddling band. What is it here about the winds that blow north and south and east and west? Of course, our jet airliners like to find them because it adds speed and saves gas. But it's an interesting thing that this book is the oldest, philologically speaking. According to the language that's used, it's the oldest, probably the oldest in the whole Bible. And it's one thing for us with all our scientific research today to know about these things, but how did old Job get hold of them to write them? They didn't have any laboratories back there in those days. And yet I have a friend who's in the science department up at Purdue University, and he tells me that the questions that God is asking of Job here are those questions to which the great research grants across the nation are being made today. Men are still trying to find these answers. And in verse 12, he asked the question about the day and the night. And in verse 26, he asked the simple question about the rain, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is and on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, to cause the bud, the tender herb, to spring forth. Where does the rain come from, Job? How do you know about that? And over in verse 31, he asks him about the constellation of the universe. Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades or loose the bands of Orion? What is it that causes these galaxies to hold together the way they do? And we look up and we say, there's the Great Dipper again, and just above it's the North Star. But what holds them there? Why is it that they stay the same? Well, that's what he's asking here. Of course, we're still trying to figure some of these things out. And Job, well, he doesn't have any more of an answer than we do at this point. And he goes on into the animal kingdom, and he takes up the vegetable kingdom. Job's response is to be found over in chapter 42, verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord, and he said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he? Job says, you're beyond me. You're beyond me. And Job answers in the latter part of verse 3:2, without knowledge, therefore, have I uttered things that I understood not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. God speaks to him again in verse 4, here I beseech thee, and I will speak, I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. Then Job speaks back again, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. It's not necessarily moral sin that he's talking about. He says, I'm limited, God. He's saying the same thing here that Peter says in the last chapter of John. God says to Peter, do you really love me? Even with the kind of love that blows hot and cold. And Peter says, you know me better than I know myself, Lord. And you know that I love you with the kind of love that blows hot and cold, but I won't talk about that other kind of love. I really won't. Job comes to the same kind of a point of humility here that Peter came to there. In verse 7, that's all that's necessary. It was so that after the Lord had spoken these words, this is the last chapter of Job, had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, Eliphaz, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. God told Eliphaz that he was wrong, and Eliphaz's whole argument in all the speeches that he made was the same as that of Bildad and Zophar's, and that was simply this, if a man suffering, you know he must have sinned. If he sins, he's going to suffer. God says, you're dead wrong. That's not necessarily right at all. And Job has been right at that point where he has insisted all the way through here that he has not done the kind of sin that could cause this kind of suffering. Ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath. Now listen, Eliphaz. Therefore take unto you 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. Him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according as the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job, and the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Remember that, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Well, let's look at it right now. It says, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came unto him all his brethren, all his sisters, and all they that had been of his acquaintance. And they did eat bread with him in his house. And they bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. The Bible's so true to life. A man's on his way up. Everybody always wants to give him something, help him out. He's on his way down, and they just let him go. And this is just the way it was. He's on his way up now, so people are coming back around again. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job in verse 12 more than the beginning. He had 14,000 sheep. You look and tell me how many sheep he had in the first chapter. Make sure. 7,000. All right. So he had 6,000 camels in the last chapter. How many thousand camels do you have in the first chapter? 3,000. He had 1,000 yoke of oxen in the last chapter. How many yoke of oxen do you have in that first chapter? 1,000 she-asses in the last chapter. How many in the first chapter? He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters in the last chapter. How many sons and daughters do you have in the first chapter?
7.
What happened? Shouldn't he have had 14 sons and 6 daughters in the last chapter? God promised that he'd double his inheritance. How do you know, bud? How do you know? 7 of those sons and 3 of those daughters are just as much alive as they ever were in heaven. And 7 of those sons and 3 of those daughters were with him down on earth. Had to double the inheritance of the animals. No life in heaven for them. They had to be doubled on earth. People, souls, children. A quiet little reference to the immortality of the soul. But for years and years and years, men pointed their attention to this and say, aha, see, the Bible made a mistake. God isn't faithful. No, God's faithful. And we're among those families that have a baby that we're looking for in heaven because we never got to know her on earth. But she'll be there. And we'll get to know her. 14 sons and 6 daughters. And 3 daughters. 6 daughters, 7 sons and 3 daughters there at the last. And he called the name of the first daughter Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Karen Hapuk. And in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. They were good looking girls. You don't expect the Bible to come through with something like that, do you? But our God is a gracious God. And their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. And after this lived Job 140 years and saw his sons and his son's son even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days.